Ladies were smiling, others were interested, but Stevedal, Danella's mate, was concerned.
I'm not sure about this, he said.
He won't hurt her, Jandalar said.
Ayla handed Janela to Jandalar, then led Wolf to Danella. She took the woman's hand and went through the process of Wolf's introduction.
The way Wolf recognizes someone is by scent, and he knows that when I introduce him to someone like this, they are friends.
Wolf sniffed at Danella's fingers, then licked them. She smiled.
His tongue is smooth, soft. Some of his fur is, too, Ayla said. He's so warm, Danella said. I've never touched fur on a warm body before. And right here, you can feel something throbbing. Yes, that's how a living animal feels.
Ayla turned to the leader of the 26th cave of the Zelandanyi.
Would you like to meet him, Stevedal?
You might as well, Danella said.
Ayla went through a similar process with him, but Wolf seemed eager to return to Danella and walked near her when they continued on to Sunview. They found places to sit, logs, padded stones, sometimes on the ground. The visitors took out their cups from pouches attached to their waistbands. They were served tea by the few people who had not gone to the meeting camp, among them both Danella's and Stevedal's mothers, who had stayed to help the leader's mate. When Danella sat down, Wolf sat beside her, but he did look at Ayla, as though asking for permission. She nodded, and he put his head down on his paws that were stretched out in front of him. Danella found herself petting him now and then. Zelandani sat beside Ayla. After she drank her tea, Ayla nursed Janela. Several people had come to chat with the first and her acolyte, but when they were finally alone, they began to discuss Danella.
Wolf seems to be offering her some comfort, Zelandani said.
I think she needs it, Ayla said. She's still so weak. I think she may have had a late miscarriage or a stillborn, and probably a difficult time before.
The first gave her a look of interest.
What makes you say that?
Because she's so thin and frail. I'm sure she's been ill or has had some problem for some time, and I noticed a certain sadness when she looked at Janela. It made me think she had had a long, hard pregnancy and then lost the baby, Ayla said.
That's a very astute judgment. I think you're right. I was thinking something very similar. Perhaps we should ask her mother. I'd like to examine her, just to make sure she's recovering well, the Danyer said. There are some medicines that could help her.
The first turned to Ayla.
What would you suggest?
Alfalfa is good for fatigue and the stinging pain when you pass water, Ayla said, then paused to think. I don't know the name, but there's a plant with a red berry that's very good for women. It grows along the ground as a small vine, and the leaves are green all year. It can be used for cramps that can come with the moontime bleeding and can ease heavy bleeding. It can encourage birth and make it easier.
I'm familiar with that one. It grows so thick it sometimes forms a mat on the ground, and birds like the berries. Some people call it birdberry, the first said. Alfalfa tea might help restore strength. Also, a decoction of the roots and bark of spikenard.
She stopped when she saw the puzzled expression on Ayla's face.
It's a tall bush with big leaves and purple berries. The flowers are small, greenish-white. I'll show you sometime. It can help if the sac that holds the baby inside a woman drops down, slips out of place. That's why I'd like to examine her, so I know what to give her. Zelandani of the 26th is a good general healer, but he may not be as knowledgeable about women's ailments. I'll have to talk to him before we leave today.
After a polite length of time, the men who came to help build the pole drag and then went to visit the home shelter of the 26th cave finished their tea
and got up to leave. The first stopped Joharan. Jandalar was with him. "Will you go to the Zelandania camp and see if you can find Zelandani of the 26th? The Danyar said quietly. "Stevedal's mate has not been well, and I'd like to see if there's anything we can do. He's a good healer, and he may have done everything that can be done, but I need to talk to him. I think it's a woman's problem, and we are women." She left the rest unsaid. "Ask him to come here. We'll wait a while."
"Should I wait here with you?" Jandalar asked the two women.
"Weren't you planning on going to the practice field?"
Joharan said.
"Yes, but I don't have to."
"Why don't you go, Jandalar? We'll be along later,"
Ayla said, brushing his cheek with hers. The two women joined Danella and the two mothers and a few others. When he saw that the first and her acolyte were not leaving, Stevedal stayed behind as well. The head Zelandani was adept at finding out what was wrong with people and soon discovered that Danella had been pregnant and the baby was stillborn, as they suspected. But she sensed that the two older women were holding something back, especially around Danella and Stevedal. There was more to the story than they were willing to say. The Danyar would have to wait for the 26th. In the meantime, the women chatted. Janela was passed around to the women, although at first Danella seemed reluctant to take her. Once she did, she held her for a while. Wolf seemed happy to stay with both of them. Ayla took the pole drag off Winnie and let her graze, and when she returned, they asked some tentative questions about the horse and how Ayla came to have her. The first encouraged Ayla to tell them. She was developing into quite a good storyteller and enthralled her listeners, especially when she added the sound effects of horse neighs and lion roars. Just as she was finishing, the Zelandani of the 26th cave appeared.
"I thought I heard a familiar lion roar," he said,
greeting them with a big smile.
"Ayla has been telling us how she adopted Winnie," Danella said. "Just as I guessed, she has some captivating stories to tell. And now that I've heard one, I want to hear more."
The first was getting anxious to leave, though she didn't want to show it. It was entirely appropriate for the first among those who served the Great Earth Mother to visit with the leader of the cave that was hosting the summer meeting and his mate, but she had many things to do. The ceremony of the rites of first pleasures would be the day after next, and then the first matrimonial of the season, though there would be another mating ceremony near the end of the summer for those who wanted to finalize their decisions before they returned to their winter shelters. The first one was invariably the largest and most well-attended. There were many plans yet to be made. While people fussed around, making more tea, since they had drunk all there was, the first and her acolyte managed to get the 26th aside and speak privately with him.
"We learned that Danella delivered a stillborn," the first said, "but more happened, I'm sure. I'd like to examine her and see if there is anything I can do to help."
He breathed a long sigh and frowned. Chapter 9.
"Yes, you are right, of course. It wasn't just a stillborn baby," the 26th said. "There were two born together, or would have been, but they were more than born together. They were joined together."
Ayla remembered that the same thing had happened to one of the women of the clan. Two babies joined together with a monstrous result. She felt a great sadness for Danella.
"One was normal size, the other much smaller and not fully formed, and parts of the second were attached to the first one," the 26th continued. "I'm glad there was no breath in them, or I would have had to take it. It would have been too hard for Danella. As it was, she bled so much I'm surprised she survived. We, her mother, Stevedal's mother, and I, decided not to tell either one of them. We were afraid it would make any later pregnancy even more distressing than a stillborn would. You can examine her if you want, but it happened some time ago, in late winter. She has healed well. She just needs to recover her strength and get through her grief. Your coming to visit may have helped. I saw her holding Ayla's baby, and I think that's good. She seems to have made a friend of you, Ayla, and your wolf, too. Perhaps she'll feel more inclined to go to the summer meeting now.
Jandalar,
Ayla said when she and the first arrived back at the camp of the Ninth Cave.
What are you doing here? I thought you were going to the summer meeting camp.
I am going there, he said. I just decided to check on Racer and Gray while I was here. I haven't spent much time with Racer, and they both seemed to enjoy the company. Why are you here?
I wanted to let Winnie feed Gray while I nursed Janela. I was going to leave Winnie here, but then we thought this would be a good time for Zelandani to ride into camp on the pole drag,
Ayla said. Jandalar grinned.
Then I'll wait, he said. In fact, why don't I ride in with you on Racer?
We'll have to take Gray with us, too,
Ayla said, frowning slightly. Then she smiled.
We can use the small halter you made for her. She's getting used to wearing it. It might be good for her to get accustomed to being around people she doesn't know.
That should make quite a show, Zelandani said, but I think I like it. I'd rather be part of a bigger production than the only one for people to stare at.
We should bring Wolf, too. Most people have seen the animals, but not together. There are still a few who can't quite believe that Winnie allows Wolf near her baby. If they see that he is no danger to Gray, it could help them realize that he's no danger to them, either,
Ayla said.
Unless someone attempted to harm you, Jandalar said, or Janela.
Jaradal and Robanan came running into the summer dwelling of the leader of the Seventh Cave.
Wimar, Thona, come and see,
Jaradal shouted.
Yes, come and see,
Robanan echoed. The two boys had been playing just outside.
They brought all the horses and Wolf. Even Zelandani is riding. Come and see,
Jaradal exclaimed. Calm down, boys, Marthona said, wondering what Jaradal meant. It did not seem possible that Zelandani could be sitting on the back of a horse.
Come and see! Come and see!
Both boys were yelling, while Jaradal tried to pull his grandam up from the cushion upon which she was seated. Then he turned to Willemar.
Come and see, Wimar.
Marthona and Willemar were visiting Serjanar and Jaivina to discuss their part in an upcoming ceremony that would involve all leaders and former leaders in a small way. They had taken Jaradal with them to keep him out from underfoot of his mother. Proliva, as usual, was involved in meal planning for the event. Soliban's pregnant mate, Ramara, and her son, Robanan, who was Jaradal's age mate and friend, had come along so the boys could play.
We're coming,
Willemar said, helping his mate up. Serjanar pushed aside the drape that covered the entrance, and all of them crowded out. The most surprising sight met them. Parading toward the Zelandania Lodge were Jandalar, on Racer's back, leading Gray, and Ayla riding the mare, with Janela in her carrying blanket sitting in front of her. Winnie was pulling a pole drag upon which the first was seated, facing backward. The wolf was padding along beside them. It was still unexpected for most people to see horses with people on their backs, not to mention the wolf nonchalantly walking with them. But to see the first among those who served the Great Earth Mother riding on a seat that was being pulled by a horse was nothing less than astonishing. The procession passed quite near the camp of the Seventh Cave, and although Marthona and Willemar and the rest of the people of the Ninth Cave were quite familiar with the animals, they gawked at the demonstration as much as anyone. The first caught Marthona's eye, and though she smiled in a decorous way, Marthona detected a sparkle of impish delight in the woman's gaze. It was more than a parade. It was a spectacle.
And if there was one thing members of the Zelandania enjoyed staging, it was a spectacle.
When they reached the entrance to the big lodge, Jandalar stopped and let Ayla and Winnie pull ahead, then dismounted and offered a hand to the first. For all her size, she stepped down from the seat on the travoy gracefully, and, perfectly aware that everyone was watching her, entered the lodge with great dignity.
"So that's what he wanted us to help him make,"
Willemar commented.
"He said he needed to build a very sturdy pole drag with shelves. It wasn't shelves he wanted, but it was clever of him to say that. None of us could imagine that they would turn out to be a seat for Zelandani. I'll have to ask her what it's like to sit on a seat that is pulled by a horse."
"It is brave of her to do that," Jaevina said. "I'm not sure that I would want to try it."
"I would,"
Geradol said, his eyes full of excitement.
"Thona, do you think Ayla would let me sit on a pole drag seat while Winnie pulled it?"
"I'd like to do it, too," Robinan said.
"The young are always willing to try something new," Ramara said.
"I wonder how many similar conversations are going on around this camp right now," Serjanar said. "But if she lets one boy do it, every other boy in camp will be clamoring to do the same."
"And quite a few girls, too," Marthona added.
"If I were her, I would wait until we get back to the ninth cave," Ramara said. "Then it wouldn't be much different from letting a child or two ride on the mare's back while Ayla leads her around, the way she does now."
"It does make quite a demonstration, though. I recall how I felt when I first saw those animals. It could be frightening. Didn't Jandalar tell us that people ran away from them when they were on their journey here? Now that we're used to them, it just seems rather impressive,"
Willemar said. Not everyone was so pleasantly impressed by the demonstration. Marona, who loved to be the center of attention, felt a surge of jealousy rise up. She turned to her cousin Wailopa and remarked,
"I don't know how anyone can stand to be around those dirty animals all the time. When you get close to her, she smells of horse, and I've heard she sleeps with that wolf. It's disgusting."
"She sleeps with Jandalar, too," Wailopa said, "and I'm told he won't share pleasures with anyone else."
"That won't last," Marona said, giving Ayla a venomous stare. "I know him. He'll be back in my bed again, I promise you."
Brukhaval saw the two cousins talking, recognized the nasty look Marona gave Ayla, and felt two opposing emotions. He knew it was hopeless, but he loved Ayla and wanted to protect her from the spitefulness of the woman who was also his cousin. He had been the brunt of her malice himself and knew how hurtful she could be. But he was also afraid that Ayla would suggest that he was a flathead again, and he couldn't stand that, even though he knew in his heart that she didn't mean it in the unkind way that most people did. He never looked at a polished, blackened wood reflector, but sometimes he caught glimpses of himself in still water and hated what he saw. He knew why people called him by that hateful name, but he couldn't bear the idea that there might be some truth to it. Madraman was also scowling at Ayla and Jandalar. He resented the way Ayla was getting so much attention from the first. Yes, she was her acolyte, but he didn't think it was right for the one who was supposed to be overseeing all the acolytes to favor her so much when they were together at a summer meeting. And, of course, Jandalar had to be in the middle of things. Why did he have to come home? Things were better while the big oaf was gone, especially after the Zelandani of the fifth cave decided to take him as an acolyte, though he thought he should have been a Zelandani by now. But what could he expect with the fat one in control? I'll think of a way, he thought. Larimar turned his back on the whole thing and walked away, thinking his own thoughts. He'd seen enough of those horses and that wolf,
especially that wolf. As far as he was concerned, they lived too close to his dwelling in the ninth cave, and they had spread out so far the horses were on the other side of him. Before they came, he could cut across the space they occupied. Now, every time he went home, he had to make a wide circle around their lodge to avoid the wolf. The few times he got too close, the animal got his hackles up, wrinkled his nose, and showed his teeth, as though the whole place belonged to him. Besides, she interfered, coming over and bringing food or blankets as though she was being nice, but she was really checking up on him. Now he didn't even have a lodge to go to, not one where he felt he belonged. The children acted as though it was theirs, but it was still his hearth, and what he did at his own hearth wasn't any of her business. Well, there were still the Falages. He actually liked staying there. He wasn't bothered by children crying in the night or his drunken mate coming in and starting an argument. At the Falage where he was staying, the other men were mostly older and didn't bother each other. It wasn't boisterous and loud like the Falages of the younger men, though if he offered one of his lodge mates a drink of his barma, they were more than happy to drink with him. Too bad there were no Falages at the ninth cave. Ayla rode Winnie slowly around the outside of the large Zelandania lodge, pulling the pole drag, then started out of the summer meeting camp back the way she had come. Jondalar followed, leading Racer and Gray. The area where the summer meeting had been set up, called Sunview, after the name of the nearby cave, was often used as a campground for large gatherings. When it rained, stones were brought from the river and the nearby cliffs to pave the ground, especially when it was unusually muddy. Each year more were added until the campsite was now defined by the large area paved by the stones. When they were somewhat outside the boundary of the camp, beyond the paving stones and in the middle of a grassy field on the floodplain of the river, Ayla stopped. "Let's take off Winnie's pole drag and leave the horses here for a while," she said, "where they can graze. I don't think they will wander far, and we can whistle them back if we have to."
"Good idea," Jondalar said. "Most people know not to bother them if one of us isn't around, and we can check on them. I'll take their halters off, too."
As they were tending to the horses, they saw Lanadar approaching, still wearing his specially made spear-thrower holder. He waved, then whistled a greeting, and received a welcoming neigh from Winnie and Racer in return.
"I wanted to see the horses," he said. "I liked watching out for them last year and getting to know them, but I haven't spent any time with them this summer, and I don't know Winnie's baby at all. Do you think they will remember me?"
"Yes. They answered your whistle, didn't they?" Ayla said.
He had brought some dried wild apple slices with him in a fold of his tunic and fed the young stallion and then his dam from his hand. Then the young man squatted down and held out a hand with a piece of the fruit to the little filly. She stayed near Winnie's back legs at first. Though Gray was still nursing, she had started mouthing grass in imitation of her dam, and it was obvious that she was curious. Lanadar was patient, and after a while the filly started edging toward him. The mare watched, but neither encouraged nor restricted her foal. Eventually, Gray's curiosity won out, and she nosed Lanadar's open hand to see what it held. She got a piece of apple in her mouth, then dropped it. Lanadar picked it up and tried again. Though she wasn't as experienced as her dam, she managed to use her incisors and flexible lips and tongue to get it in her mouth and bite. It was a new experience for her and a new taste, but she was more interested in Lanadar. When he began to stroke her and scratch her favorite places, she was won over. When he stood up, he had a big smile.
"We were going to leave the horses here in this field for a while and check on them every so often,"
Jondalar said.
"I'd be happy to watch them, like I did last year," Lanadar said. "If there are any problems, I'll look for you or whistle."
Ayla and Jondalar looked at each other, then smiled.
I would be grateful for that, Ayla said. I wanted to leave them here so people would get more used to seeing them and they'd get more comfortable around people, especially Gray. If you get tired or have to go, whistle loud or come and find one of us and let us know.
I will, he said.
They left the field feeling much more relaxed about the horses. When they returned in the evening to invite Lanadar to share a meal with their cave, they found that several young men and a few young women, including Lanoga, carrying her youngest sister Lorela, were visiting with him. When Lanadar had watched the animals the year before, it was at the enclosure and nearby field that was close to the camp of the Ninth Cave, which was some distance from the main camp. Not many people went there, and he had few friends then anyway. But since he had developed his skill with the spear thrower and was hunting regularly, he had gained more status. He had also gained several friends and, it seemed, a few admirers. The young people were involved with each other and didn't notice Ayla and Jondalar coming. Jondalar was pleased to see that Lanadar was acting very responsibly, not allowing the group of youngsters to crowd in around the horses, especially Gray. He had obviously allowed the visitors to stroke and scratch them, but only let one or two at a time get close. He seemed to sense when the horses were tired of all the attention and just wanted to graze, and quite firmly told one of the youngsters to leave them alone. The couple didn't know that he had banished some young men earlier who had become too rambunctious by threatening to tell Ayla, who, he reminded them, was the acolyte of the first among those who served the Great Earth Mother. The Zelandania were the ones whom people went to for help and assistance, and though they were respected, often revered, and many of them were loved, the feeling for them was always tempered with a little fear. The Zelandania were intimate with the next world, the world of spirits, the fearsome place where one went when the Elan, the life force, left their body. They had other powers that went beyond the ordinary, too. Youngsters often spread rumors, and boys, in particular, liked to scare each other by telling stories about what a Zelandani might do, especially to their male parts, if one of them made one angry. They all knew that Ayla seemed to be a normal woman with a mate and a baby, but she was still an acolyte, a member of the Zelandania, and a foreigner. Just listening to her speak emphasized her strangeness and made them aware that she was from some other place, a distant place, farther away than anyone had ever traveled, except for Jondalar. But Ayla also exhibited extraordinary abilities, like having control over horses and a wolf. Who knew of what she might be capable? Some people even looked askance at Jondalar, though he was born to the Zelandanyi, because of the strange ways he had learned while he was gone. "Greetings, Ayla and Jondalar and Wolf," Lanadar said, which caused some of his young visitors who had not noticed their arrival to turn around sharply. They seemed to appear so suddenly. But Lanadar knew they were coming. He had noticed a change in the behavior of the horses. Even in the darkening twilight, the animals were aware of their approach and were edging toward them.
"Greetings, Lanadar," Ayla said. "Your mother and grandmother are at the camp of the Seventh Cave, along with most of the Ninth Cave. You have been invited to share a meal with them."
"Who will watch the horses?" he said, leaning down to pet Wolf, who had come to him.
"We have already eaten. We'll take them back to our camp," Jondalar said.
"Thank you for looking out for them, Lanadar," Ayla said. "I appreciate your help."
"I liked doing it. I'll watch them any time," Lanadar said.
He meant it. Not only did he enjoy the animals, but he liked the attention it brought him. Being responsible for them had brought several curious young men and young women to visit. With the arrival of the first among those who served, the summer meeting camp was soon caught up in the usual hectic activity of the season. The rites of first pleasures had the usual complications,
but none that had been as difficult as the one Janita had posed the year before when she turned up pregnant before she'd had her first rites, especially when Paradol's mother had objected to the mating of her son with the young woman. The mother's opposition was not entirely unreasonable, since her son could count only 13 years and a half, and Janita could count only 13. It wasn't only their youth. Although Paradol's mother didn't want to admit it, the first was sure she also objected because a young woman who shared pleasures before her first rites lost status. But because Janita was pregnant, she also gained status. Several older men had been more than willing to offer her their hearths and welcome her child, but Paradol was the only one with whom she had shared pleasures, and she wanted him. She had done it not only because he had pressed her so persistently, but because she loved him. After the ceremony of first rites, it was time to organize the first matrimonial of the summer. Then a large herd of bison was spotted nearby, and the leaders decided that a major hunt was in order before the matrimonial rites. Joharan discussed it with the first, and she was agreeable to postponing the ceremony. He was anxious to have Jandalar and Ayla use the horses to help drive the bison into the surround that was constructed to corral the animals. The value of the spear throwers could be shown in hunting down the ones that evaded the surround trap. The leader of the ninth cave continued to encourage people to see how a spear could be cast from a much greater and safer distance with the spear thrower. The implements were already becoming the weapon of choice for most of the people who'd had a chance to see them in action. The lion hunt was already common knowledge at the meeting. The lion hunters had been enthusiastically telling the story of the dangerous confrontation. Younger hunters were especially excited about the new weapon, and quite a few of the older ones were as well. Many of those who were less keen were the ones who were skilled in using a hand-flung spear. They were comfortable hunting the way they always had, and not eager to learn a new method at such a late stage in their lives. By the time the hunt was over, and the meat and skins preserved or put aside for further processing, the first matrimonial had already been delayed too long to suit many. The day of the communal mating ceremony had dawned bright and clear, and an air of anticipation filled the whole camp, not just those who would be participating. It was a celebration that everyone looked forward to, one that they all took part in. The ceremony included the voiced approval of the newly mated couples by all the people at the summer meeting. The matings created changes in the names and ties of more than the new couples and their families. The status of nearly everyone shifted to some degree, some more than others, depending on the closeness of their relationships. The matrimonial the year before had been a stressful time for Ayla, not only because it was her mating ceremony, but because she had so recently arrived and was the center of so much attention. She wanted Jandalar's people to like and accept her and was trying to fit in. Most of them did, but not all of them. This year, the leaders and former leaders, as well as the Zelandania, were seated strategically so they could answer when the first asked for responses from those present, which to her meant approvals. The first had not been pleased with the hesitation from some of the crowd the year before when she asked for the endorsement responses for Ayla and Jandalar, and she did not want that to become a practice. She liked her ceremonies to run smoothly. The accompanying festivities were anticipated with great relish. People prepared their best dishes and wore their best clothes, but the mating festival was not only a joyous occasion for the ones that were mating, it was also the most appropriate occasion for a mother festival. Then everyone was encouraged to honor the Great Earth Mother by sharing her gift of pleasure with joinings and couplings as often as one was able, and with whomever one chose, so long as the feeling was reciprocated. People were encouraged to honor the mother, but it was not required. Certain areas were set aside for those who did not wish to participate. Children were never required, though if some of them bounced around with each other in imitation of the adults, it usually drew indulgent smiles. Some adults just didn't feel like it, especially those who were sick or hurt or recovering from accidents or just tired, or women who had recently given birth or were having their moon time and bleeding. A few of the Zelandania who were undergoing certain trials that required abstaining from pleasures for a period of time volunteered to tend to the young children and help the others. The one who was first was inside the Zelandania dwelling, sitting on a stool. She swallowed the last of her cup of hawthorn flowers and catmint tea and pronounced, "It's time." She gave the empty cup to Ayla, got up and walked toward the back of the lodge to a small, secondary, somewhat concealed access that was camouflaged on the outside by a construction used to hold additional wood. Ayla sniffed the cup. It was an automatic, habitual action, and almost as subconsciously, she noted the ingredients and reflected that it was probably the woman's moon time. Catmint, the waist-high, downy-leafed perennial with the whorls of white, pink, and purple flowers, was a mild sedative that could relieve tension and cramps. She wondered about the hawthorn, however. It had a distinctive taste, and maybe she liked the flavor, but it was also one of the ingredients the first used in the medicinal preparation that she made for Marthona. Ayla was now aware that the medicines the Zelandani gave Jondalar's mother were for the heart, the muscle in her chest that pumped blood. She had seen similar heart muscles in the animals she hunted and subsequently butchered. Hawthorn helped it to pump more vigorously and more rhythmically. She put the cup down and exited out the main entrance. Wolf was waiting outside and looked expectantly at Ayla. She smiled, shifted John Ayla, who was asleep in her carrying blanket, and hunkered down in front of the animal. Taking his head in both hands, she looked in his eyes.
"Wolf, I am so glad that I found you. Every day you are here for me, and you give me so much," she said, ruffling his shaggy hair.
Then she bent her forehead to touch his.
"Are you coming with me to the matrimonial?"
Wolf continued to look at her.
"You can come, if you want, but I think you'll get tired of it. Why don't you go hunt?"
She stood.
"You can go, Wolf. Go ahead, hunt for yourself," she said,
moving her hand toward the boundary of the camp. He looked up at her a little longer, then jogged off. Ayla was wearing the clothing that she had worn when she mated Jondalar, her matrimonial outfit, which she had carried with her for the entire year-long journey from the home of the Mamutoi, far to the east, to the home of Jondalar's people, the Zelandani, whose territory extended to the great waters of the west. The matrimonial did remind many people of the previous year's event. Several people talked about Ayla's unusual outfit when she appeared wearing it again, but it also reminded Zelandani of the objections to her that some people had put forth. Although they weren't usually direct about it, the first knew it was primarily because Ayla was a stranger, and a stranger with uncanny abilities. Ayla was going as a spectator rather than a participant this time and was looking forward to just watching the ritual. Recalling her mating ceremony, she knew the ones who were promised were gathering in the smaller lodge nearby, dressed in their finery and feeling nervous and excited. Their witnesses and guests were also congregating in the front section of the viewing area, with the rest of the camp filing in behind them. She walked toward the large area where people gathered for various functions that involved the whole camp. When she arrived, she stopped to scan the crowd, then headed toward the recognizable faces of the ninth cave. Several people smiled when she approached, including Jondalar and Joharan.
"You are looking particularly nice this evening," Jondalar said. "I haven't seen those clothes since this time last year."
He was wearing the simple, pure white tunic, decorated only with ermine tails, that she had made for him for their mating. On him, it looked stunning.
That Mamutoi outfit does become you, his brother said.
He did think so, but the leader of the Ninth Cave also understood how much wealth it displayed.
Nezi, the mate of the headman of the lion camp, and the woman who had persuaded the Mamutoi to adopt her, had given the garments to Ayla, but their creation had been requested by Mamut, the holy man who had actually adopted her as a daughter of the Mammoth Hearth. They originally had been made for her, when it was thought that she would mate Rainik, who was the son of the mate of Nezi's brother Wymez. Wymez had traveled far to the south in his youth, mated an exotic, dark-skinned woman, and returned after 10 years, unfortunately losing his woman on the way. He brought with him fantastic stories, new flint-napping techniques, and an amazing child with brown skin and tight black curls, who Nezi raised as her own. Among his light-skinned, fair-haired northern kin, Rainik was a unique boy who always caused an exciting stir. He grew into a man with a delicious wit, laughing black eyes that women found irresistible, and a remarkable talent for carving. Like the rest, Ayla had been fascinated by Rainik's unusual coloring and charm, but he also found the beautiful stranger enthralling, and showed it, which brought out a jealousy in Jondalar that he didn't know he had. The tall blonde man with the compelling blue eyes had always been the one that women couldn't resist, and he didn't know how to handle the emotion he had never experienced before. Ayla didn't understand his erratic behavior and finally promised to mate Rainik because she thought Jondalar no longer loved her, and she did like the dark carver and his laughing eyes. The lion camp grew fond of Ayla and Jondalar that winter they lived with the Mamutoi, and they all had been more than aware of the emotional difficulties of the three young people. Nezi in particular developed a strong bond with Ayla because of her care and understanding of another unusual child the woman had adopted, who was weak, unable to speak, and half-clan. Ayla treated his weak heart and made his life more comfortable. She also taught Rydag the clan sign language, and the ease and speed with which he learned it made her understand that he did have the clan memories. She taught the whole lion camp a simpler form of the unspoken language, so he could communicate with them, which made him extremely happy, and Nezi overjoyed. Ayla quickly grew to love him, in part because Rydag reminded her of her own son, whom she'd had to leave behind, but more for himself, though ultimately she hadn't been able to save him. When Ayla decided to return home with Jondalar, instead of staying to mate Rainik, though Nezi knew how much Ayla's leaving hurt the nephew she had raised, she gave the young woman the beautiful garments that had been made for her, and told her to wear them when she mated Jondalar. Ayla didn't quite realize how much wealth and status the matrimonial clothing conveyed, but Nezi did, and so did Mamut, the perceptive old spiritual leader. They had guessed from his bearing and manner that Jondalar came from people of high status, and that Ayla would need something to give her a good standing among them. Though Ayla didn't quite understand how much status her matrimonial outfit displayed, she did understand the quality of the workmanship. The hides for the tunic and leggings had come from both deer and saiga antelope, and were an earthy golden yellow, almost the color of her hair. Part of the color was the result of the types of wood that were used to smoke the hides to keep them supple, and part the result of the mixtures of yellow and red ochres that were added. It had required a great deal of effort to scrape the skins to make them soft and pliable, but rather than being left with the velvety suede-like finish of buckskin, the leather had been burnished, rubbed with the ochres mixed with fat, using an ivory smoothing tool that compacted the hide to a lustrous, shiny finish that made the soft leather almost waterproof. The long tunic, sewn together with fine stitches, fell to a downward-pointing triangle at the back. It opened down the front, with the sections below the hips tapering, so that when it was brought together, another downward-pointing triangle was created. The full leggings were close-fitting, except around the ankle, where they could bunch softly or be brought down below the heel, depending on the footwear that was chosen. But the quality of the basic construction only laid the groundwork for the extraordinary outfit. The effort that went into the decoration made it an exquisite creation of rare beauty and value. The tunic and lower part of the leggings were covered with elaborate geometric designs made primarily of ivory beads, some sections solidly filled in. Colored embroideries added definition to the geometric beaded pattern. They began with downward-pointing triangles, which horizontally became zigzags and vertically took on the shapes of diamonds and chevrons, then evolved into complex figures such as rectangular spirals and concentric rhomboids. The ivory beads were highlighted and accentuated by amber beads, some lighter and some darker than the color of the leather, but of the same tone. More than 5,000 ivory beads made from mammoth tusks were sewn onto the garments, each bead carved, pierced, and polished by hand. A finger-woven sash in similar geometric patterns was used to tie the tunic closed at the waist. Both the embroidery and the belt were made of yarns whose natural color needed no additional dyeing. Deep red woolly mammoth hair, ivory mouflon wool, brown muskox underdown, and deep reddish-black woolly rhinoceros long hair. The fibers were prized for more than their colors. They all came from animals that were difficult and dangerous to hunt. The workmanship of the entire outfit was superb in every detail. It was evident to knowledgeable Zelandanyi that someone had acquired the finest materials and assembled the most skillful and accomplished people to make the garments. When Jandalar's mother had first seen it the year before, she knew that whoever had directed the outfit to be made commanded great respect and held a very high position within his community. It was clear that the time and effort it took to make it were considerable. Yet the outfit had been given to Ayla when she left. None of the benefits of the resources and work that went into making it would stay within the community that made it. Ayla said she had been adopted by an old spiritual man she called Mamut, a man who obviously possessed such tremendous power and prestige, in effect, wealth, that he could afford to give away the mating outfit and the value it represented. No one understood that better than Marthona. Ayla had, in effect, brought her own bride price, which gave her the status that she needed to contribute to the relationship so that mating her would not lower the position of Jandalar or his kin. Marthona made a point of mentioning that to Proliva, who she knew would tell her husband Joharan, Marthona's eldest son, leader of the Ninth Cave. Joharan was glad to have an opportunity to see the prized possession again, now that he fully understood its value. He realized that if properly cared for, and he was sure it would be, the clothing would last a long time. The ochres used to burnish the leather did more than add color and make it water-resistant. They helped to preserve the material and make it resistant to insects and their eggs. It would likely be used by Ayla's children, and perhaps their children, and when the leather finally disintegrated, the amber and ivory beads could be reused for many more generations. Joharan knew the value of ivory beads. Recently, he'd had occasion to trade for some, for himself, but especially for his mate, and recalling the transaction, he looked at Ayla's rich and luxurious clothing with new appreciation. As he looked around, he noticed that many people were surreptitiously watching her. Last year, when Ayla wore it for her matrimonial, everything about her was strange and unusual, including the woman herself. Now, people had become more accustomed to her, to the way she spoke, and to the animals she controlled. she was looked upon as a member of the Zelandania, and therefore her strangeness seemed more normal, if one could consider any Zelandani normal. But the outfit made her stand out again, made people recall her foreign origins, but also the wealth and status she brought with her. Among those watching her were Morona and Wailopa.
"Look at her flaunting that outfit,"
Morona said to her cousin, her eyes full of envy. She would have been more than happy to flaunt it.
"You know, Wailopa, that wedding outfit should have been mine. Jandalar promised me he should have come back and mated me and given that outfit to me."
She paused.
"Her hips are too broad for it anyway,"
Morona said with scorn. As Ayla and the others were making their way to a place that the Ninth Cave had claimed for watching the festivities, both Jandalar and his brother saw Morona. She was staring at Ayla with such malevolence, it made Joharan apprehensive, for Ayla's sake. He glanced at Jandalar, who had also seen Morona's glare of hatred, and a look of shared understanding passed between the two brothers. Joharan moved closer to Jandalar.
"You know that if she can, she will cause trouble for Ayla someday,"
the leader said under his breath.
"I think you're right, and it's my fault, I'm afraid,"
Jandalar said.
"Morona thought I promised to mate her. I didn't, but I understand why she may have thought so."
"It's not your fault, Jandalar. People have a right to make their own choices,"
Joharan said.
"You were gone a long time. She had no claim on you, and shouldn't have had any expectations. After all, she mated and separated in the time you were gone. You made a better choice, and she knows it. She just can't stand it that you brought back someone who has more to offer than she does. That's why she'll try to cause trouble some day."
"Perhaps you're right,"
Jandalar said, though he didn't quite want to believe it. He wanted to give Morona the benefit of a doubt. As the ceremony got underway, the two brothers got caught up in it, and thoughts of the jealous woman were forgotten. They hadn't noticed another pair of eyes that were also watching Ayla, their cousin, Brukaval. He had admired the way Ayla stood up to the derisive laughter of the cave when Morona tricked her into wearing inappropriate clothing that first day. When they met that evening, Ayla recognized his look of the clan and felt comfortable with him. She treated him with an easy familiarity that he wasn't used to, especially from beautiful women. Then, when Cherizal, that stranger from a distant Zelandani cave, began to make fun of him, derisively referring to him as a flathead, Brukaval flew into a rage. He had been teased with that name by the other children of the cave for as long as he could remember, and Cherizal had obviously gotten wind of it. He had also heard that the way to get a reaction from the strange-looking cousin of the leader was to make innuendos about his mother. Brukaval never knew his mother. She died soon after he was born, but that only gave him reason to idealize her. She was not one of those animals. Could not be, and neither was he. Though he knew Ayla was Jandalar's woman, and there was no way he could ever win her from his tall, handsome cousin, in his mind, seeing her stand up to everyone's laughter and not giving in to the ridicule made him admire her. For him, it was love at first sight. Though Jandalar had always treated him well and never joined in when the others teased him, at that moment he hated him. And hated Ayla as well, because he couldn't have her. All the hurt that Brukaval had felt in his life, together with the nasty remarks from the young man who was trying to take Ayla's attention away from him, erupted into uncontrollable anger. Afterward, he noticed that Ayla seemed more distant, and no longer spoke to him with that familiar ease. Jandalar didn't say anything to Brukaval about her change in feeling toward him after his outburst, but Ayla had told him that Brukaval's anger reminded her too much of Braud, the son of the leader of her clan. Braud had hated her from the beginning and had caused her more pain and heartache than she ever could have imagined.
She had learned to hate Braud as much as he hated her, and with good reason to fear him. It was because of him that she was finally forced to leave the clan and to leave her son as well. Brukhaval remembered the warm glow he'd felt when they first met and watched Ayla from a distance whenever he could. The more he watched, the more enamored he became. When he saw the way she and Jandalar interacted, Brukhaval would imagine himself in his cousin's place. He even followed them when they went to some secluded place to share pleasures, and when Jandalar tasted her milk, he hungered to do the same. But he was wary of her, too, afraid she would call him a flathead again, or her word for them, the clan. Just their name, flatheads, had caused him so much pain as he was growing up that he couldn't bear the sound of it. He knew she didn't think of them the way most people did, but that made it worse. She sometimes spoke of them fondly, with affection and even love, and he hated them. Brukhaval's feelings for Ayla were at cross purposes. He loved Ayla, and he hated her. The ceremonial part of the matrimonial was long and drawn out. It was one of the few times when the complete names and ties of each of the promised mates were recited. The matings were accepted by the members of their caves, agreeing aloud, and then by all the Zelindanyi in attendance doing the same. Finally, they were physically joined by a thong or cord, which was wrapped, usually, around the right wrist of the woman and the left wrist of the man, although it could be the reverse, or even both left or both right wrists. After the cord was knotted, it would stay that way for the rest of the evening's festivities. People always smiled at the inevitable stumblings and bumpings of the newly mated ones, and while it might be funny to watch, many observed carefully to see how they reacted, how quickly they learned to accommodate each other. It was the first test of the bond to which they had just committed, and the elders made whispered opinions to each other about the quality and longevity of the various matings, based on how well they became accustomed to the restriction of being physically bound to each other. Mostly they would smile or laugh at each other and themselves, and make efforts to work things out, until later, when they were alone and could untie, never cut, the knot. As difficult as it might be for couples, it was even more so for those who had decided on a triple, or more rarely, a foursome, but that was considered only proper, since such a relationship would require more adaptation to succeed. Each person had to have at least one free hand, and so it was usually the left hands of multiples that were bound together. Walking from place to place, getting food and eating, even passing water or more solid elimination, all had to be synchronized, whether it was two or more that had joined. Occasionally, a person just couldn't stand the restraint and would become frustrated and angry, which never bode well for the mating, and rarely the knot would be severed to break the relationship before it ever began. The severed knot was always the sign of the end of a mating, just as the tying of the knot symbolized the beginning of one. Chapter 10. The matrimonial usually began in the afternoon or early evening to leave plenty of time for the festivities as it grew dark. The singing or reciting of the mother's song always ended the formal mating ceremony and signaled the beginning of the feasting and other celebratory activities. Ayla and Jandalar stayed through the entire formal ceremony, and though she was feeling bored before it was over, she would never admit it. She had watched people coming and going throughout the afternoon and realized that she was not the only one who grew tired of the long recitation of names and ties and the repetition of ritual words, but she knew how important the ceremony was to each couple or multiple and to their immediate kin, and part of that was the acceptance by all the Zelindanyi in attendance. Besides, all of the Zelindania were expected to remain until the end, and she was included among them now.
Ayla had counted 18 individual ceremonies when she saw the first gather them all together. She had been told there might be 20 or more, but some of them were not certain. There were any number of reasons why participation in the formal mating ceremonial might be postponed, especially the first one of the season, ranging from uncertainty if the couple was ready to make the commitment to an important relative being delayed. There was always the matrimonial at the end of the season for final decisions, late arriving kin, arrangements not yet completed, or new summer liaisons. Ayla smiled to herself when she heard the rich, full tones of the first singing the opening verse of the mother's song. Out of the darkness, the chaos of time, the whirlwind gave birth to the mother sublime. She woke to herself, knowing life had great worth. The dark, empty void grieved the great mother earth. The mother was lonely. She was the only. Ayla had loved the legend of the mother the first time she heard it, but she particularly loved the way it was sung by the one who was first among those who served the Great Earth Mother. The rest of the Zelandanyi joined in, some singing, some reciting. Those who played flutes added their harmonies, and the Zelandania chanted a fugue in counterpoint. She could hear Jandalar, who was standing beside her, singing. He had a good, true voice, though he didn't sing often, and when he did, it was usually with the group. Ayla, on the other hand, couldn't carry a tune. She never learned how, and didn't seem to have a natural inclination for singing. The best she could do was a sing-song monotone, but she had memorized the words and spoke them with deep feeling. She particularly identified with the part where the Great Earth Mother had a son. The mother's great joy, a bright, shining boy, and lost him. Tears came to her eyes whenever she heard, "The great mother lived with the pain in her heart that she and her son were forever apart. She ached for the child that had been denied, so she quickened once more from the life force inside. She was not reconciled to the loss of her child." Then came the part where the mother delivered all the animals, also her children, and especially when she gave birth to first woman and then first man. To woman and man, the mother gave birth, and then for their home, she gave them the earth, the water, the land, and all her creation. To use them with care was their obligation. It was their home to use, but not to abuse. For the children of Earth, the mother provided the gifts to survive, and then she decided to give them the gift of pleasure and sharing that honors the mother with the joy of their pairing. The gifts are well earned when honors returned. The mother was pleased with the pair she created. She taught them to love and to care when they mated. She made them desire to join with each other. The gift of their pleasures came from the mother. Before she was through, her children loved too. Earth's children were blessed. The mother could rest. That was the part everyone was waiting for. It meant the formalities were over. It was time for feasting and other festivities. People started milling around, waiting for the feast to be set out. John Ayla, who had been sleeping contentedly while Ayla was sitting quietly, started to squirm around when they all joined in on the mother's song. She woke up when her mother got up and started moving. Ayla took her out of her carrying blanket and held her out over the ground where she let go of her water. She had learned quickly that the sooner she went, the sooner she'd be out of the cold and held close to a warm body again.
"Let me take her,"
Jandalar said, reaching for the child. John Ayla smiled at the man, which elicited a smile in return.
"Wrap her in this blanket,"
Ayla said, handing him the soft hide of a red deer that she was using to carry her.
"It's getting chilly, and she's still warm from sleep."
Ayla and Jandalar walked toward the camp of the third cave. They had enlarged their space to include room for their neighboring cave in the main summer meeting area. The ninth put up a couple of shelters for their own use, especially during the day, but they still referred to it as the camp of the third cave. They also tended to share meals and join together for feasts, but matrimonial feasts were always prepared and shared by the entire group. They joined the rest of Jandalar's family and friends who were bringing food to the large meeting area of the summer camp near the Zelandania Lodge. Proliva, as usual, organized the entire affair, assigning tasks and delegating individuals to be responsible for various jobs. People were coming from all directions, bringing the components of the great feast. Each camp had developed their own variations on the standard ways of cooking the substantial quantity and diversity of foods that were available in the region. The abundant grasslands and gallery forests along rivers provided rich feed for the many varieties of large grazing or browsing animals, including aurochs, bison, horse, mammoth, woolly rhinoceros, megaseros, reindeer, red deer, and several other types of deer. Some animals that in later times retreated to mountains spent certain seasons on the cold plains, like the wild goat known as ibex, the wild sheep called mouflon, and a goat antelope referred to as chamois. A sheep antelope named Saiga lived on the steppes all year. In the coldest part of winter, musk oxen also appeared. There were also small animals, usually caught in traps, and fowl, often brought down with stones or throwing sticks, including Ayla's favorite, ptarmigan. A wide selection of vegetables were available, including roots such as wild carrots, cattail rhizomes, flavorful onions, spicy little pig nuts, and several different kinds of starchy biscuit roots and ground nuts that were collected with digging sticks, then eaten raw, cooked, or dried. Thistle stems held up by the flower head so the sharp thorns could be scraped off before cutting were delicious when lightly cooked. Burdock stems required no special handling, but needed to be picked young. The green leaves of lamb's quarter made a wonderful wild spinach. Stinging nettles were even better, but had to be picked with a large leaf from another plant to protect the hand from the stinging, which disappeared when they were cooked. Nuts and fruits, especially berries, were also in abundance, and an assortment of teas was provided. The steeping of leaves, stems, and flowers in hot water, or just letting them sit out in the sun for a while, was usually enough to make an infusion with the desired flavors and characteristics, but steeping was not a sufficiently rigorous process to extract the flavors and natural constituents from hard organic substances. Barks, seeds, and roots usually required boiling to make the proper decoctions. Other beverages were available, like fruit juices, including fermented varieties. Tree saps, particularly birch, could be boiled down to bring out the sugar and then fermented. Grains, and of course honey, could also be made into an alcoholic drink. Marthona provided a limited quantity of her fruit wine, Larimar some of his barma, and several others had brought their own varieties of drinks with variable alcoholic content. Most people brought their own eating utensils and bowls, although a supply of wood or bone platters and carved or tightly woven bowls and cups were offered for those who wanted to use them. Ayla and Jandalar walked around greeting friends and sampling the foods and drinks offered by different caves. John Ayla was often the center of attention. Some people were curious to see if the foreigner who had grown up with flatheads, whom some still considered animals, had given birth to a normal child. Friends and relatives were just pleased to see that she was a happy, healthy, and very pretty little girl, with fine, almost white, soft, curly hair. Everyone also knew immediately that it was Jandalar's spirit that the Great Mother had selected to mix with Ayla's to create her daughter. John Ayla had the same extraordinarily vivid blue eyes. They passed by a group of people who had set up camp on the edge of the large communal area, and Ayla thought she recognized some of them.
"Jandalar, aren't those people traveling storytellers?" she asked. "I didn't know they were coming to our summer meeting."
"I didn't know either. Let's go and greet them."
They hurried to the camp.